She only threw me out twice. But she arrived in the village the day of, now I haven't lived there since 1961, of my wife's and my 30th anniversary, and handed us a happy anniversary card. That just kind of blew me away.
It was my privilege.
Maybe we should just let her tell us.
Betty, it's time to go home. The blurb on the kiosk said this was about Beloved and Song of Solomon, and what I meant to write was that Pilate Dead, the character in the Song of Solomon, is a beloved character. It's not about that book, the Beloved, that she wrote. And another way to introduce this, perhaps, is that on the door of my office at Augustana, I have a Charlie Brown cartoon, and Lucy Van Pelt, little Lucy, walks up to Charlie Brown with a stack of books, one book, and says, Charlie Brown, I've got 5 chapters to read in here, and I don't understand it, and can you help me with that? And Charlie Brown says, go read the chapters and come back, and I'll try to help you. And the last frame is, she's standing there, read them?
You're probably the only person in the world that knows her name is Lucy Van Pelt.
Yeah. Well, that's the extent of my sophisticated reading. That's what it's all about. That's right. So I don't expect that you have read Song of Solomon. Maybe some of you have, and if you have, sure, chime in anywhere. But because I suspect you haven't, I have 3 goals. One, this is the book, Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison. It's written in 1977, and it's in the bookstore. And one of my goals of 3 is to hopefully kind of entice you to read it. If you can't buy it here, and I get 10% of everything bought over there. So if you can buy it here, that'd be great. If I can entice you to read it, that's goal number one. Goal number two is to try to shape how character and theme fit together. And I'm going to do that by looking at just one character. There are lots of great, unconventional, really fun to read and get to know characters in this novel. We're going to just look at one, and her name is Pilate Dead. And for whatever it's worth to you, out of all the characters that I've taught and read in American literature, Pilate Dead is my favorite. So there's something enticing about her anyway that I hope I can share. And the other thing is to try to suggest how fiction tells the truth, and how fiction brings us can bring us into a whole different reality that's important for us to explore. I taught in the seminary a few years ago, and in the class I had there, one of the students said, asked what we were going to read in the class, and it was almost all fiction and poetry. And he was about 35 years old, and he said, I've never read anything but autobiography and essay and, you know, nonfiction stuff. So I'm here to, that's another goal, is to help create a sense of what fiction does. What you need to know, and maybe I should put this on the board just to help our memories go as we go along, is that there's a character named Macon, and his sister is Pilate. Their last name is Dead, and how they get that, read the book, it's not so important for tonight. Macon has 3 kids. He's married to a woman named Ruth, or her name was, Ruth Foster, and they have 3 kids, and all their names are picked out kind of blindly. One is Corinthians, another one is Lena, and the third one is Macon, and since this Macon is Macon the second, this is Macon the third, but throughout the novel he goes by the name of Milkman. And that's a very interesting thing that I'll leave for you to read the book and find out how he gets that name. Pilate is unmarried, but she has an affair in a short time while she's living on an island trying to get her life discover something about herself. And she has an affair with a guy who quickly leaves her once he finds out what's wrong with her. And she has a daughter then, not named Lena, named Reba. And that's important, especially for something I'll read at the end. And then Reba also has an affair and has a daughter named Hagar. And the other character to know is a guy named Guitar. And already you can tell that it's a strange mix of names, and that's part of the wonder of the book. But what we need to remember is that Macon and Pilate are brother and sister. Macon or Milkman, Macon III or Milkman is his son, and therefore Pilate's nephew. She has a daughter and then a granddaughter, and Guitar is their friend. And so I'm just going to, because Toni Morrison says it better than I could ever say it, read to you, and as we go, just ask questions about what's the sense that you get from what we have so far. And the first thing I think to read is how Pilate gets her name. And I have to keep the sheet with me that's got all my page references. And I'm standing back here because that's where the light is. Okay, we're going to go and we'll have fun, I hope. Pilate is born or emerges about a minute after her mother dies. And so it's up to her father to name her. How his father, Macon is telling the story about Pilate getting her name. Father, confused and melancholy over his wife's death and childbirth, had thumbed through the Bible, and since he could not read, chose a group of letters that seemed to him strong and handsome. Saw them in a large figure that looked like a tree hanging in some princely but protective way over a row of smaller trees. I guess I should have made a big P and it would look like that. How he had copied the group of letters out on a piece of brown paper, copied as illiterate people do, every curlicue, arch, and bend in the letters, and presented it to the midwife. That's the baby's name. You want this for the baby's name? I want that for the baby's name. Say it. You can't name the baby this. Say it. It's a man's name. Say it. Pilate.
What?
Pilate. You wrote down Pilate. Like a riverboat pilot? No, not like a riverboat pilot. Like a Christ-killing pilot. You can't get much worse than that for a name. And a baby girl at that. That's where my finger went down. Well, your brain ain't got to follow it. You don't want to give this motherless child the name of the man that killed Jesus, do you? I asked Jesus to save me and my wife. Careful, Macon. I asked him all night long. He'd give you your baby. Yes, he did. Baby named Pilate. Next guy says, Jesus, have mercy. Well, Pilate, she and Macon grow up together for about 15 years, and then they separate. And Pilate, after trying to get a hold of what her life is, has this affair, gives birth to Reba. Reba gives birth to Hagar, and she decides that Hagar needs to have some kind of stability in her life. So she heads back to where Macon the second lives because she wants to be around family. Well, by this time, Macon, her brother, has kind of made it in the society, and herein comes one major theme, and I'll just let you discover that. And because he's kind of made it, Pilate, this very unconventional character, comes to town, and he's ashamed of her. She can do witchcraft. Well, I'll just read. They've been talking, and finally he had told her not to come again until she could show some respect for herself, to get a real job instead of running a wine house. Why can't you dress like a woman? He was standing by the stove. What's that sailor's cap doing on your head? Don't you have stockings? What are you trying to make me look like in this town? He trembled with the thought of the white men in the bank, the men who had helped him buy and mortgage houses, discovering that this raggedy nigger bootlegger was his sister, that the propertied Negro who handled his business so well and who lived in the big house on Not Doctor Street had a sister who had a daughter but no husband, and that daughter had a daughter but no husband, a collection of lunatics who made wine and sang in the streets like common street women, just like common street women you are. Pilate had sat there listening to him, her wondering eyes resting on his face, and then she said, I've been worried sick about you too, Macon. Well, a little more about Macon, and I'm kind of using Macon, we're really going to talk about Pilate, but as a foil, as the setup for the kind of values and the kind of life that Pilate lives. And here's an illustration of Macon. And he owns a lot of property, and he's really a slum landlord. As he was thumbing through his accounts book, the stout woman entered alone. This is not Pilate. Afternoon, Mr. Dead, sir. I'm Mrs. Baines. live over at number 3 on 15th Street, making dead remembered. Not the woman, but the circumstances at number 3. His tenant's grandmother or aunt or something had moved in there and the rent was long overdue. Yes, Mrs. Baines, you got something for me? Well, that's what I come to talk to you about. You know, Chintzy left all them babies with me, and my relief check ain't no more than it take to keep a well-grown yard dog alive. Half alive, I should say. Your rent is $4 a month, Mrs. Baines. You're 2 months behind already. I do know that, Mr. Dead, sir, but babies can't make it with nothing to put in their stomach. Their voices were low, polite, without any hint of conflict. Can they make it in the street, Mrs. Baines? That's where they're going to be if you don't figure out some way to get me my money. No, sir, they can't make it in the street. We need both, I reckon, same as yours does. Well, then you better rustle it up, Mrs. Baines. You got till... He swirled around in his, to consult the calendar on the wall. Till Saturday coming. Saturday, Mrs. Baines. Not Sunday, not Monday, Saturday. What's it gonna profit you, Mr. Dead, sir, to put me and them children out? Saturday, Mrs. Baines. When Mrs. Baines closed the door, Macon Dead went back to the pages of his accounts book, running his fingertips over the figures. But Macon Dead is missing something. We can see it already, but he knows it too. But he can't seem to pull away from this strong, as we've been saying for 2 weeks here in the work camp, this strong pull for hoarding manna. But one night, shortly after this conversation with Mrs. Baines, he heads home from work. This will say something about Macon, and then you'll get the connections to Pilot. Tired, irritable, he walked down 15th Street, glancing up as he passed one of his other houses, its silhouette melting in the light that trembled between dusk and twilight. Scattered here and there, his houses stretched up beyond him like squat ghosts with hooded eyes. He didn't like to look at them in this light. He decided to take a shortcut back to not Doctor Street, that's the street he lives on, even though to do so would lead him past his sister's house, where Pilot lived in a narrow single-story house whose basement seemed to be rising from, rather than settling into, the ground. She had no electricity because she would not pay for the service, nor for the gas. At night, she and her daughter lit the house with candles and kerosene lamps. They warmed themselves and cooked with wood and coal. Unkempt, yes, but not dirty. The whites of her fingernails were like ivory, and unless he knew absolutely nothing, this woman was definitely not drunk. Of course, she was anything but pretty, yet he knew he could have watched her all day, the fingers pulling thread veins from the orange sections, the buried black lips that made her look as though she wore makeup, the earring. And when she stood up, he all but gasped. She was as tall as his father, head and shoulders taller than himself. Her dress wasn't as long as he had thought. It came to just below her calf, and now he could see her unlaced men's shoes and the silvery brown skin of her ankles. She held the peelings precisely as they had fallen in her lap. As she walked up the steps, she looked as though she were holding her crotch. Your daddy wouldn't like that. He don't like dumb peoples. And she looked right at Milkman, one hand holding the peelings, the other on the doorknob. I know your daddy. I know you, too. In the heartbeat of silence that followed, Pilot laughed. You all want a soft-boiled egg? The boys looked at each other. She had changed rhythm on them. They didn't want an egg, but they did want to be with her, to go inside the wine house of this lady who had one earring, no navel, and looked like a tall black tree. No thanks, but we'd like a drink of water. Well, step right in. She opened the door and they followed her into a large, sunny room that looked both barren and cluttered. A moss-green sack hung from the ceiling. Candles were stuck in bottles everywhere. Newspaper articles and magazine pictures were nailed to the walls. But other than a rocking chair, two straight-back chairs, a large table, a sink and stove, there was no furniture. Pervading everything was the odor of pine and fermenting fruit. You ought to try one. I know how to do them just right. I don't like my whites to move, you know. The yolk I want soft, but not runny. Want it like wet velvet. How come you don't just try one? She had dumped the peelings in a large crock, which, like most everything in the house, had been made for some other purpose. Now she stood before the dry sink, pumping water into a blue and white wash basin, which she used for a saucepan. Now, The water and the egg have to meet each other on a kind of equal standing. One can't get the upper hand over the other, so the temperature has to be the same for both. I knock the chill off the water first, just the chill. I don't let it get warm because the egg is room temperature, you see. Now then, the real secret is right here in the boiling. When the tiny bubbles come to the surface, when they get as big as peas, and just before they get big as marbles, well, right then, you take the pot off the fire. You don't just put the fire out, you take the pot off. Then, you put a folded newspaper over the pot and do one small obligation, like answer the telephone, answer the door, or empty the bucket and bring it off the front porch. I generally go to the toilet. Not for a long stay, mind you, just a short one. If you do all that, you got yourself a perfect soft-boiled egg. Well, she goes on to tell, are you with her? You're getting into who Pilot is. Okay. She tells Milkman and a guitar a story next, and the story is about when she was out with her brother, Macon, Milkman's father, and they were afraid of the dark. And Macon tells, again, they're just kids, tells Pilot, you don't have to be afraid of anything. These things aren't real. And Pilot has this response to that. Now, we lost, and there was this wind, and in front of us was the back of our daddy. The back of our daddy is, it's a wonderful part of the story, too. He is murdered by some white guys who want to get his land, but he keeps coming back talking to Pilot long after he's dead. And so she sees him. And that becomes one of the themes, and I'm going to ask you what this whole little short scene says to you. We were some scared children. Macon kept telling me that the things we were scared of wasn't real. But what difference do it make if the thing you're scared of is real or not? I remember doing laundry for a man and his wife once down in Virginia. The husband came into the kitchen one afternoon shivering and saying, did I have any coffee made? I asked him what it was that had grabbed hold of him, and he looked so bad. He said he couldn't figure it out, but he felt like he was about to fall off a cliff. Standing right there on that yellow and white and red linoleum as level as a flat iron. He was holding on to the door first, then the chair, trying his best not to fall down. I opened my mouth to tell him it wasn't no cliff in that kitchen. And then I remembered how it was being in those woods. I felt it all over again, being afraid that it wasn't real. So I told the man, did he want me to hold on to him so he couldn't fall? He looked at me with the most grateful look in the world. Would you? He said. I walked around back of him and locked my fingers in front of his chest and held on to him. His heart was kicking under his vest like a mule in heat. But little by little, it calmed down. You saved his life, said Guitar. No such thing. His wife came in before it was time to let go. She asked me what I was doing, and I told her. Told her what? What'd you say? The truth. That I was trying to keep him from falling off a cliff. I bet he wished he had jumped off then. She believed you? Don't tell me she believed you. Not right away, she didn't. But as soon as I let go, he fell dead weight to the floor, smashed his glasses and everything, fell right on his face. And you know what? He went down so slow. I swear it took 3 minutes, 3 whole minutes to go from a standing upright position to when he mashed his face on the floor. I don't know if the cliff was real or not, but it took him 3 minutes to fall down it. Well, what do you make of that? I asked earlier, one of the goals was to try to understand how fiction can bring us into a whole, is the phrase, I hate it, new paradigm, another way to think, another kind of reality that's worth our journeying. Yeah.
Well, I'm struck by the, it doesn't matter if it's real or not, you're equally afraid.
Yeah.
And that rather than judging the cause of fear, you step in and do something to help somebody.
Yeah.
That's what she does.
That's a great answer. This is on red and white linoleum, right? And it's level as a flat iron. But he actually does fall. So what's the reality? This floor, this level, or is there something else that's, where does that come from? And I think we're...
Perception.
Oh, good.
That claustrophobia, I can relate.
Yeah. You're afraid of heights on a level, huh?
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. Well, it's a different world, and she is sensitive to the, not to what the guy, I like the word perception, I like the word different reality. She's sensitive not to what, oh, come on, don't be stupid, but this is a whole other reality, and it's in his spirit, it's in his heart. And then we get to meet her with another, I have a question I wrote in my notes to ask you now, because it fits this, and I'm coming back to my notes, they're good to have, I guess. Who are our heroes in life? Just rattle off some that you think are your heroes.
Desmond Tutu.
Well,
Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Mother Teresa.
Well, we can go on for a long time, but think of those heroes, and now, what do they have in common?
Courage.
Courage.
Humility.
Humility. Mm-hmm.
They love their neighbors.
They love their neighbors, and the neighbor is unconditional, unqualified. And they must have a different kind, what?
They have something to die for.
Yeah, and Pilate does die.
Struggle with God.
What?
Struggle with God.
And the struggle with God, all of them. You know, whose world is this? One of my favorite questions in Sophie's Choice. Tell me, at Auschwitz, where was God? The answer, where was man? And whose responsibility is it? So they struggle with that, and what's our role? And part of all that you said points to that there's some different kind of vision about what makes up human life, and that who am I going to fight for, and who am I going to die for, and who's my neighbor? And it's a different vision than most of us have. Pilate has that, and I thought of this scene as I listened to Ingrid Christiansen do her wonderful session on the death penalty today. Reba, as I mentioned, gives away everything. Milkman happens to be coming into the house just at the time when Hagar runs into the house with Milkman. And here it is. When he got to Pilate's, he walked in on a domestic crisis. Reba's new man friend had asked her for a small loan, and she had told him that she didn't have any money at all. Page 92. You already know on page 92 that Reba, if she has money, she gives it away. She doesn't keep it. She gives it to any man that's her friend. She'll give it to him. The man who had received two or three nice presents from her unasked thought she was lying and was trying to tell him to shove off. They were quarreling in the backyard. That is, the man was quarreling. Reba was crying and trying to convince him that what she had said was true. Just after Milkman opened the door, Hagar came running from the bedroom where she'd been looking out the back window. She screamed to Pilate, Mama, he's hitting... It's really her grandmother. Mama, he's hitting her. I saw him with his fist, Mama. Pilate looked up from a fourth grade geography book she was reading and closed it. She is always reading this geography book. Another theme. Read the book. You'll enjoy that part of it. Slowly, it seemed to Milkman, she walked over to a shelf that hung over the dry sink, put the geography book on it, and removed a knife. Slowly still, she walked out the front door. There was no back door. And as soon as she did, Milkman could hear Reba's screams and the man's curses. It didn't occur to him to stop Pilate. Her mouth was not moving and her earring flashed fire. But he did follow her, as did Hagar, around to the back of the house, where, approaching the man from the back, she whipped her right arm around his neck and positioned the knife at the edge of his heart. She waited until the man felt the knife point, before she jabbed it skillfully about a quarter of an inch through his shirt into the skin. Still holding his neck so he couldn't see but could feel the blood making his shirt sticky, she talked to him. Now, I'm not going to kill you, honey. Don't you worry none. Just be still a minute. The heart's right here, but I'm not going to stick it in any deeper. Because if I stick it in any deeper, it'll go straight through your heart. So you have to be real still. You hear? You can't move an inch, because I might lose control. It's just a little hole now, honey. No more than a pin scratch. You might lose about 2 tablespoons of blood, but no more. And if you're real still, honey, I can get it back out without no mistake. But before I do that, I thought we'd have a little talk. The man closed his eyes. Sweat ran from his temples down the sides of his face. A few neighbors who had heard Reba's screams had gathered in Pilate's backyard. They knew right away that the man had to be a newcomer to the city. Otherwise, he would have known a few things about Reba, one of which was that she gave away everything she had, and if there was a case quarter in that house, she'd have given it to him. And more important, he would have known not to fool with anything that belonged to Pilate, who never bothered anybody, was helpful to everybody, but who also was believed to have the power to step out of her skin, set a bush afire from 50 yards, and turn a man into a ripe rutabaga. All on account of the fact that she had no navel. So they didn't have much sympathy for him. They just craned their necks to hear better what Pilate was telling him. You see, darling, that there is the only child I got, the first baby I ever had. And if you could turn around and see my face, which of course you can't because my hand might slip, you'd also know she's the last. Women are foolish, you know, and mamas are the most foolish of all. And you know how mama are, don't you? You got a mama, ain't you? Sure you have, so you know what I'm talking about. Mamas get hurt and nervous when somebody don't like their children. First real misery I ever had in my life was when I found out somebody, a little teeny tiny boy it was, didn't like my little girl. Made me so mad I didn't know what to do. We do the best we can, but we ain't got the strength you men got. That's why it makes us so sad if a grown man start beating up on one of us. You know what I mean? I'd hate to pull this knife out and have you try some other time to act mean to my little girl. Because one thing I know for sure, whatever she done, she's been good to you. Still, I'd hate to push it in more and have your mama feel like I do now. I confess, I don't know what to do. Maybe you can help me. Tell me, what should I do? The man struggled for breath and Pilate eased up on his throat, but not his heart. Let me go. He whispered. Let me go. I won't never put a hand on her. I promise. A real promise, sugar? Yeah, I promise. You won't never see me no more. Reba sat on the ground, her arms around her knees, staring through her unswollen eye at the scene as though she were at a picture show. Her lip was split and her cheek was badly bruised. And though her skirt and hands were stained with her effort to stop the blood pouring from her nose, a little still trickled down. Pilate plucked the knife out of the man's shirt and took her arm away. He lurched a little, looked down at the blood on his clothes and up at Pilate, and licking his lips, backed all the way to the side of the house under Pilate's gaze. Her lips didn't start moving again until he was out of sight and running down the road. Well, what do you think of Pilate? Yeah.
I think that's effective negotiation. You want to have the undivided attention, and you want to offer them choices. That's what she did in a very clear and calm way. It was a very reasonable negotiation technique.
Good. What do we know about Pilate? What does she wear? Men's shoes, no socks, untied. Sailor's cap.
Long white dress.
Long black dress.
Big earring.
One. What's her house
she's
like?
She's tall.
She's tall.
Black lips.
No lipstick, no makeup. Someone, right after the scene, I didn't read this line, but when they're talking about we women ain't as strong as you men, guitar turns to Milkman and says, yeah, like a B-52 bomber. What else do we know about her?
Extremely protective.
Protective.
She has
protective
no
of those she loves. Yeah.
She has no navel.
And she has no navel. So do you like
her?
What?
Otherworldly
for sure. That she talks to the dead. She can understand a different kind of reality for this the pain that this guy's in that he might cause him to fall.
That Pilate loves deeply. And Reba loves absolutely unconditionally.
I put that word up here because it's surely one of the themes.
I learned that in a diesel tank.
Pilate's independent and strong, but she has a sense of humor, even in that tense situation.
Yeah, she does. And how important that is, throughout the book, this woman has this sense of humor. And how else does she survive? Because we already know that Well, we'll learn, we already know because we've read, you know, if you're far enough in the book, that she is ostracized by everybody. She, in this affair she has on the island, she tries to get a job and nobody will hire her, and she gets a job on this island, and when they find out how hard she works, they think that she's terrific, and she starts this affair with this guy, but she never undresses. This isn't described in, specifically in the book, it just says this. She never undresses in front of him, and when she does, she just makes sure that the light doesn't hit her belly so that he can see this. But the people find out that she has no navel, and they kick her out. And then she has another affair with a guy, and he wakes up in the morning, looks at her, and says, "Oh my God, what are you, some kind of mermaid?" And he runs off. And so she never has a chance to participate in both intimate love, or into any kind of community love, because they ostracize her. So thus she lives in this house. She's totally unconventional. And the narrator says this, and then we're almost to the heart of this, and on the way to the narration illustrates this notion of unconditional love. And how does somebody get to that? What's the process of being able to love so unconditionally that she doesn't kill this guy? Think of you, if you have daughters or sisters or moms, and somebody, you know, how bad was Reba hurt? Couldn't even see out of one eye. Her nose is still bleeding. Her lip is cut. If that were your daughter, what would you do? And she's got this. Here's the scene where, after a while, she stopped worrying about her stomach, stopped trying to hide it. It occurred to her that although men screwed armless women, one-legged women, hunchbacks and blind women, drunken women, razor-toting women, midgets, small children, convicts, boys, sheep, dogs, goats, liver, each other, and even certain species of plants. I'm not even going to try to get into the anatomy of that. They were terrified of her, a woman with no navel. One of the things that Scheer points out throughout the novel is that this is surely an innocuous difference. Who cares? And that list of all the people that would be different, they seem to be greater differences. But this, they froze at the sight of that belly that looked like a back, became limp even, or cold if she happened to undress completely and walk straight toward them, showing them deliberately a stomach as blind as a knee. What are you? Some kind of mermaid? One man had shouted and reached hurriedly for his socks. And then this assessment by the narrator. It isolated her. Already without family, she was further isolated from her people, for, except for the relative bliss on the island, a few short months, every other resource was denied her. Partnership in marriage, confessional friendship, and communal religion. Men frowned, women whispered, and shoved their children behind them. Even a traveling sideshow would have rejected her, since her freak quality lacked that important ingredient, the grotesque. There was really nothing to see. Her defect, frightening and exotic as it was a theatrical failure. It needed intimacy, gossip, and the time it took for curiosity to become drama. Pilate finally began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, she threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. I'm going to continue, but I'm going to write these words. And just for a moment, I'm going to go back to what her brother says to his son, to her nephew, says to Milkman early, and this is about, I read it now, I'm going back because this is about assumptions and anything but a zero. Macon, the second, calls his, he doesn't call his son Milkman, he's not. And so when Macon the second refers to his son, he calls him Macon. "I haven't changed my mind, Macon, I don't want you over there." "Why? You still haven't said why." "Just listen to what I say. That woman's no good. She's a snake. It can charm you like a snake, but still a snake." "You talking about your own sister, Dad, the one you carried in your arms to the fields every morning. That was a long time ago. You've seen her. What she looks like to you? Somebody nice? Somebody normal? Well, or somebody to cut your throat? She didn't look like that, Daddy. Well, she is like that. What'd she do? It ain't what she did, it's what she is. Ooh. Well, what is she? A snake! I told you. Ever hear the story about the snake? The man who saw a little baby snake on the ground? Well, the man saw this baby snake bleeding and hurt, lying there in the dirt, and the man felt sorry for it and picked it up and put it in his basket and took it home. And he fed it and took care of it till it was big and strong, fed it the same thing he ate. Then one day, the snake turned on him and bit him, stuck his poison tongue right into the man's heart. And while he was laying there dying, he turned to the snake and asked him, "What'd you do that for? Didn't I take good care of you? Didn't I save your life?" The snake said, "Yes." "Then what did you do it for? What'd you kill me for?" Know what the snake said? Said, "But you knew I was a snake, didn't you? Now I mean for you to stay out of that wine house and as far away from Pilate as you can." Listen to this. Pilate lowered his head. His father had explained nothing to him. What does milkman, Nick in the third, know that his father doesn't? And it has to do with the line, "It's not what she does, it's what she is." What is she to make it?
An ant.
An ant to milkman, a sister to him, a snake to him, but it's all, your word, it's all, this is his perception. What perception from the little I've read of Pilate do you have? Would you want to have dinner with her?
Yeah.
Would you want to stop by and let her cook you an egg?
Yeah.
It'd be a good one.
You, on the unconditional love, my experience in observing people is those who are best able to do unconditional love are those who have endured the most hurt.
Who would what?
Endured the most hurt.
Oh, and she does.
Yes.
No communal religion, no intimate friendship, no chance of partnership and marriage. It isolated her, the narration says.
And the way she is a product of starting at zero, because she's denied the reference point of behavior and environment, so she does it herself in a way that is true unto herself.
I'm gonna do this, that's good. We'll try to figure out quickly what zero isn't. And here's part of what zero isn't. I'm continuing with Macon's discussion with his son. He told her to stay away from her. Milkman lowered his head. His father explained nothing to him. "Boy, you got better things to do with your time than go over to her house. Besides, it's time to start learning how to work." Work is one of the things that ain't zero. And every time I read this passage, I think of that poem by the Indian prophet Smahala, who says, "My men shall never work, for men who work cannot dream, and wisdom begins in dreams." And it's a whole new paradigm about, I mean, we got names for those little kindergarten kids that don't work, right? Or that dream. They're daydreamers and they're lazy, and here comes a prophet, "My men shall never work for work." Every time I read that poem, I also think that's because the women probably do. But "My men shall never work, for men who work cannot dream, and wisdom begins in dreams." Well, you learn how to work. You start Monday. After school, come to my office, work a couple of hours there, and learn what's real. What's real is the floor, but not the pilot. What's real to Pilate is the hurt and the fear that this man has. "Pilate can't teach you a thing you can use in this world." I love this line, and Toni Morrison hits it, doesn't she? "Pilate can't teach you a thing you can use in this world. Maybe the next, but not this one." So we got a whole lot of things, and one of them is, and another one that I didn't read about and won't. Macon walks around because he's got all his property with his keys on his belt. And every once in a while, he just grabs those keys and fingers them and feels them, and it's power, it's ownership, it's work, it's money. Let me tell you right now the one important thing you ever need to know. If you were here for the work week, Dan Erlander, the Bible study guy, taught us this about this a lot. The one thing you ever need to know: own things. It's the American way. And let the things you own other things. And then you'll own yourself and other people too. Starting Monday, I'm going to teach you how. Mm-hmm. Now we're back to Pilate. She threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. First off, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad and what is the difference? Hmm. When is making happy? In just what I've read to you.
Never.
Well, but there's one time when he is.
Listening to the music?
When he's listening to the music of his sister. And he walks away and then he turns around and walks back. And he loved looking at them freely, he said. But that's the only time he's happy. Is he happy at home? Tuck in your shirt. Don't bring in that mess. When am I... First off, she cut her hair. One thing she didn't want. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad and what is the difference? What do I need to know to stay alive? What is true in the world? Her mind traveled crooked streets and aimless goat paths, arriving sometimes at profundity, other times at the revelations of a three-year-old. But throughout this fresh, if common, pursuit of knowledge, one conviction crowned her efforts. Since death held no terrors for her, she spoke to the dead, she knew there was nothing to fear. Surely. And you can, when, if you read, as you read the book, you'll think of all the things that Macon is afraid of. Right on, I read to you. He was afraid of what those white men might think of him, those guys who loaned him the money. And well, so she gets rid of all that. She's nothing to fear. What people say about her. She's a B-52 bomber. She can't be afraid of physical harm. That is her nothing to fear. That plus her alien's compassion for troubled people ripened her and, the consequence of the knowledge she had made up or acquired, kept her just barely within the boundaries of the elaborately socialized world of black people. Her dress might be outrageous to them, but her respect for other people's privacy, which they're all very intense about, was balancing. She stared at people, and in those days, looking straight into another person's eyes was considered among black people the height of rudeness, an act acceptable only with and among children and certain kinds of outlaws. But she never made an impolite observation. And true to the palm oil that flowed in her veins, she never had a visitor to whom she did not offer food before one word of conversation, business or social, began. She laughed, but never smiled, and she gave up, apparently, all interest in table manners or hygiene, but acquired a deep concern for and about human relationships. And then I got to read the ending, and then we'll just let you see what you say. The story is not only about Pilate. Milkman is another major character, and it's his coming to awareness, coming to a consciousness of his self, of his identity, and he too has what I would call a kind of existential stripping. And he has to start at zero, get rid of all his assumptions about his family and making money and how he treats women, and all that's part of the book. And in the end of the book, the very end of the book, he has arrived and he's almost there, where a major theme in the book is that he learns to fly. As Guitar tells him, his friend, when they're older, and now 30 years old, Milkman asks why peacocks can't fly. And Guitar says, peacocks can't fly because they got all that jewelry. And you got to get rid of the ship that wears you down before you can fly, and it holds you down. Well, the ship that holds them down is all this stuff that comes in there in the place of the zero. You got to get rid of that. And here it is in less locker room language. She stripped away every assumption she had and began at zero. Well, at the end, Milkman and Pilate, a whole other part of the plot, go out with her father's bones to bury them, finally, after years and years and years. She'd had them in her house all along, but didn't know it. They take them out to bury them, and Guitar, who by now is an enemy of Milkman's, for another complicated and wonderful part of the plot reason, thinks that this bag contains gold, and he wants the gold, and he's willing to kill for it. So here are Pilate and Milkman burying these bones, and so they have the sack with them, and Guitar stands up on the next mountain over and shoots. And here's the end. Pilate laid the bones carefully into the small grave. Milkman heaped dirt over them and packed it down to the back of his shovel. Should we put a rock or a cross on it? Milkman asked. Pot shook her head. She reached up and yanked her earring from her ear, splitting the lobe. Then she made a little hole with her fingers and placed it in Sing's snuff box. That's her mother. And she didn't know that then, but now she does. Into Sing's snuff box with a single word that her father ever wrote. She stood up then, and it seemed to Milkman that he heard the shot before she fell. He dropped to his knees and cradled her lolling head in the crook of his arm, barking at her. You hurt, pilot? She laughed. And he knew right away that that was the most, that she was reminded of the day he first met her and said the most stupid thing there was to say, which was,
hi.
And now asking her if she's hurt. The twilight had thickened and all around them it was getting dark. Milkman moved his hand over her chest and stomach, trying to find a place where she might be hit. Pilot, you okay? He couldn't make out her eyes. His hand under her head was sweating like a fountain. Pilot, she sighed. Watch Reba for me. And then, I wish I'd have known more people. I would have loved them all. If I'd have known more, I would have loved more. Okay. What do you see? What do you want to talk about? You've got 4 minutes. Anybody want to read Song of Solomon? That was one of the quotes. Yeah.
How did you compare that to Beloved?
Personally, I don't think there's any comparison. I think this is her best book by far. Beloved won the Pulitzer Prize. She has won the Nobel Prize, as you know, for her body of work. But Beloved has beautiful language. And I liked it. But it doesn't have I don't think, personally, that it has the truths about who we are that are as insightful and as emotionally profound as they are here.
What was the relationship with her father? Was it positive all through?
Yes, all through. Her father, in spite of the fact that he gave her this terrible name, they worked together on the farm, Macon and Pilot and her father, and he's successful. And here's where some African American history comes into the novel. Any successful black, Richard Wright writes about it, Alice Walker, lots of writers do. A successful black is going to be, he's a threat to the white establishment, especially the economic establishment. Richard Wright writes about an uncle who had a successful tavern, was taking business away from the white taverns, and the white people killed him. That's autobiographical, not fiction. He is a successful farmer. The white farmers come, and as it's described in here, he's sitting on the edge of a fence looking at his land, and they come with five guys and blow him off the fence with a shotgun. but before that happens, we see them working together, Pilot chewing her pine cone, her pine needle, and walking side by side with her father and her brother in these really happy days. And I talked with a young woman who's out of the village, right, Lisa, who's out of the village right now, but she read this for the first time and had, I thought, a great insight. I'd never read any critic that had said anything like this. That Macon isn't really such a bad guy. He's trying to get back to that great love that he knew, but that he had taken on so much, as Guitar calls it, shit, you know, the stuff that weighs you down, that he could never get back to zero, even though he tried. You know, and he tried to love, and he tried to go back and, you know, peek in the window and watch Pilot, but he was swept away by the power of, I guess, the economic hoarding of man. Yeah.
Do people see her as a Christ figure through here?
Do you?
Non-biological birth, the kind of experience positive with father, going through life as zero, rejected by people. Do you see her as a Christ figure?
I got two answers. One is, did the analogy, or the allusion, I guess, that David Wee pointed out about the prodigal son, does that enhance the richness of the story? And does thinking of Pilate as a Christ figure enhance the richness of the story? That's, you know, you to answer. My own answer would be, yep. One of the things that Jesus insists upon over and over again is this kind of existential stripping. Sell all you have. Love me more than your brother. Forget, those of you without sin until the first stone. He's saying something about the laws of Deuteronomy and those numbers. So if that seems to enhance it, yeah, good. 1, 2.
The quintessential question of Pilate is what is truth, but it seems like Pilate in the novel is truth.
Very good. And Pilate in the Bible says, what is truth? And then this Pilate. Yeah, I'm sure that Toni Morrison isn't, I mean, I know that she's conscious of those kinds of things. But that's a great, that enhances the sense of this too. She's truth, and truth is not the stuff. Truth is, I saw
conditional love.
Who else did I hand? Pete, yeah.
Well, it seems that her compassion and her behavior is based on incredible self-knowledge. And that she really has to turn inward by necessity to get it.
Yep. Have you read this?
No.
No, it sounds like you have almost for that assessment. She reads this geography book all the time. And it's about, where have I been? Where am I going? And it's this journey that becomes a metaphor for this, that what you've just said is this inward journey. Yeah, that's really good.
The dilemma for me to understand is the isolation, because the sadness, the sorrow in that last part, where if she could have known more people, she could have loved more. I can't make that fit with some of the other things that you've been saying.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I never thought of that till right now. There's, you'll be rejected by, there's the Christ figure that could help explain that, maybe.
Well, I just wonder how many Pilates are in our life and how welcoming we are. This is real nice sitting here saying how nice Pilate is, but I'm not so sure that we haven't, I'll speak for me, that I haven't rejected Pilates in my life.
Cool. That's why she wrote the novel.
Yeah.
Who are there?
It sounds good, but I think reality is, yeah, she didn't have many friends in her life because we don't accept her.
Who are the Pilates?
The
people we leave out.
On the street.
The what?
The homeless bag lady on the street.
The homeless bag lady?
Just anybody who's a little different in school. I mean, think of the people in school who are different, and then it's people at work who are different. I think we reject a lot of different people, and she was different.
Everybody connected to the institutional church ought to understand this fiction. Who do we leave out? Who do we exclude? Because they don't have a navel. Only that's the metaphor for a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
There are many Pilates at Holden who, when they're not at Holden, they are Pilates in the outworld. And one of the reasons so many Pilates come here is because here they can meet people.
It's very good. And we know what you're talking about. Good. David.
And I like the fact that before she even talks to people, she feeds them. And I think of Jesus asking Peter, do you love me? Feed my lambs.
And he asked it again.
Pardon? And he asked it three times. And tend my sheep and feed my sheep.
Yeah. And I love the line from J.D. Salinger's, the big famous book.
Catcher
in the Rye. Holden Caulfield was arguing with his friend who's a Quaker. And the Quaker friend says to him, you have to love all the disciples. And Holden Caulfield, in his rebelliousness, says, the hell I do. I don't have to. The disciples were worthless. They didn't help Jesus at all. And I can quote him now. They're about as much use to him as a hole in the head, especially before he died. but then the Quaker comes back and says, but you have to love the disciples because Jesus picked them. And Holden Caulfield says, I know he picked him, but he picked him at random. And the way that fits in this is that he didn't walk up and say, follow, are you straight or gay? Are you Republican or a Democrat? Or like I used to say with college kids, what's your grade point? No, it's just follow me. Yeah, good.
The whole thing of her differentness being not having a label, I think is so... I mean, it helped me because you think about these reasons we reject people, and they are as meaningless, really, as that is.
Great phrase. This is a meaningless reason to reject somebody. It is, in the language of probably the way literary critics would put it, it's absurd. And how many other absurd, and this is where the fiction tells the truth, absurd reasons do we reject people? No navel, you can think of them. Black skin.
And we seem to almost like to search that out and pick out these things and the path.
And James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, he says, the minute we look at something different, our whole foundation is shaken and shattered, and our earth is torn apart, and we don't like it.
I think she's rejected because her truth is so painful when you have a lot of peacock feathers. And oh, yeah. It's hard to take the truth. And that navel, to me, is a symbol of all of that. That she's not connected to this world in some ways, that she's free. And that very freedom is what's frightening to us when we have put all of our security in other things.
Yep. This is this world. That's what Macon calls it. She can teach you nothing in this world, maybe the next. But the next is, if in my own personal life, I'm imposing and how I read lots of literature, is that this is the kingdom of God. And most of us, and here's Danny Salinger again in another book called Franny and Zooey. Zooey is talking with Franny and she says, who but Jesus? He's the smartest guy in the Bible, says Franny. Who but Jesus knew, really knew, I'm quoting, that the kingdom of God is inside us. We're all too goddamn stupid, sentimental, and unimaginative to look. And the stupidity and the unimaginative look, stupid, sentimental, and the sentimental things, she doesn't have any sentimental attachment to anything except people. Because she gives everything away, right? Serves eggs. Anything else? You guys are great. There's a bus that goes out tomorrow. It's going straight to Augustana. I'll take you all in class. Guarantee you an A. Anybody else? I think it's about time for the talk.